All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Brian McCullough. As you know, we've been trying to cover, from every angle, the innovations that e-commerce sites in general, and Amazon.com specifically, brought into the world. And that's why I was absolutely thrilled to get to speak with Greg Linden, who was one of the early Amazon engineers who was responsible for a lot of the personalization and data-driven innovations at Amazon, especially the vaunted recommendation engine. In this episode, Greg explains in great detail the technological challenges involved, but also gives us a conceptual and almost philosophical background to the ways that harnessing data and deploying personalized systems can improve commerce systems. My thanks to Greg Linden for this excellent conversation and episode. Greg Linden, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Oh, great to be here.
So let's start by painting a scene here. It's late 1996, early 1997, I guess, and you're graduating. Are you graduating from the University of Washington at this point?
Well, no, actually. So I was at University of Washington in the computer science department working on AI research, had a few projects going, and I decided to take a break, and I was interested in going to another company for, I was just planning on a year at the time, ended up being a lot more than that, but I was just planning on leaving for a year, and ended up going to Amazon.
So your original intention was to go back to school eventually?
Right, and finish my PhD. But instead, I ended up at Amazon. At the time, it was just a small bookstore. It was only selling books. It was brand new to be selling books on the web, and it was a very, very small company, just sitting there on Second Avenue in Seattle, right across the street from a methadone clinic and a kind of crazy wig shop.
And Amazon was the only company that you looked around at the time?
No, actually, I did talk to a few others, but I was really excited about the idea of selling books. It was really fun to me to try to get the right book into the right person's hands.
Well, so tell me about the interview process, the hiring process at Amazon.
Well, at the time, Amazon was really small. I got to talk with Jeff Bezos for a while, talked to Shell, who's the first employee. All the software engineering team fit in a small room at that point, so I got to talk to a lot of the very early people, the people who had built the company, including, when Amazon first started, when a sale would come in, a little bell would go off, and this was the team that built all of that initial thing. That bell quickly became a din and had to be turned off. I was just a little bit before my time, and I got to interview with all those early people.
So you sign on early 1997.
That's right.
And you're describing it as, you know, this is such early days, it's still such a small company, and in fact, I guess space was so limited that your first desk is in the kitchen of the offices?
That's right. So Amazon was growing extremely fast even at this point. The sales were coming in rapidly. The company was trying to grow and grow and grow. And it was in this tiny space there on 2nd Avenue, and there wasn't any office space left. People were double bunking up in offices, triple bunking up. And my first office was a kitchen. So I was sitting there in the back of a kitchen. People would come in and get their tea while I was working. And there I was typing away in this kitchen.
But it was a good way to actually get to know everybody in the company, because everybody comes in there at one point or another, right?
That's right. In fact, I ended up trying to hook people into conversations, because you first come into a company, everyone's busy, and you don't know anything. So I put out a little candy jar and tried to attract people to walk over to my desk so I could ask them a couple questions while they're there trying to get a piece of candy.
And I have to ask everybody this, because it's the fun little story, but I'm assuming you assembled your own door desk.
You know, actually, I don't think I ever did build a door desk. Oh. The door desks were pretty funny, though. You know, it was essentially four by fours, a big construction four by fours, stapled, well, angle bracketed, but basically stapled to a door, literally a door. It was an enormous desk, was the advantage. You ended up with this huge desk, and everybody had them, except me at the beginning, because I was in a kitchen and I had a card table. But then I got a door desk later.
So describe for us then, not just the state of the company, but the state of the technology that you start to work with. At this point, it's the system that Shel Caffin and Paul Davis have put together. And what is that system? What are you looking at and learning?
That's right. I mean, this was quite early, so there was just a single web server and a single database. This is way before people started scaling out the system to have multiple web servers and multiple databases. There was just one web server and one database. The company only sold books. We didn't start selling music and video yet. We weren't international. We were U.S. only. Only had one warehouse at this point, and it was in Seattle. So it was very early days. It was literally just a bookstore and just selling books. And this was also the very, very early days of the web. So these days people are using technologies like CSS, cascading style sheets, and they're using JavaScript to make their web pages dynamic. This is way before all of that. In fact, cookies had just come out and weren't even widely supported, so we couldn't even count on being able to keep track of people's shopping carts using a cookie. That's how early this was. HTML was very, very basic. A lot of people still used text-based web browsers to access the site, so we still had the ability to for the site to display well and for people to be able to order books using links, which is a text-based web browser. People could still email in order to order the book. Some people preferred to email in. Some people, oddly, preferred to email their credit card in. They wouldn't type their credit card into the web pages, but they would email it, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
So very, very early days of the web. This is when very few people were comfortable with online shopping, and the web, barely worked. It was only kind of one step above the extremely early things like Archie and Gopher that were the predecessors to the web.
And what's your specific remit? What are the projects that you're put on initially?
Well, you know, like in most companies, you're given a first project where you're supposed to do something small just to get used to the code base. I think there had been a project sitting around that I was given really early on about trying to do discounting. That project ended up being not very successful. It touched kind of every piece of the code, so it was successful in that way because pricing impacts almost everything. But ultimately what ended up working really well is couponing. This was a different mechanism where people were essentially labeled as part of a group when they came to a special page on the website. It was called group discounts. And that didn't actually go extremely well. But pretty soon after that, I got involved in the personalization and recommendations on the website. So this is everything that tries to make the Amazon store different when a different customer comes to it. It's like the store automatically adapts to you, changes to you, and tries to feature things you might be interested in.
Well, let's get into that a little bit because, you know, one of the revolutions of e-commerce is not just, you know, things like, you know, having an unlimited store, unlimited products and things like that, but it's also the data that you can mine, that you can use to serve customers better. And that's the personalization that you're talking about. That's the direction that Amazon moved in and really started to revolutionize things, right?
That's right. So you have, you know, on the web, if you're an online store, you have this really unusual opportunity to show different stores to different people. You don't have to just show the same storefront. It doesn't have to look like walking into the same bookstore and all the shelves are in the same spot as one customer walks in. You can take each customer as they walk in and kind of magically rearrange the store as they walk into the room. So the shelves, in my case, I like maybe science fiction and nonfiction. So the shelves for science fiction and nonfiction might shuffle up to the front as I walk into the store, and the shelves for, let's say, romance novels, which I would never buy, kind of shuffle into the back and disappear. And that way, I see the things that I'm interested in the store, and the things I'm less interested in kind of disappear to the back. It's taken a lot of people a very long time to kind of get used to this idea that you can present a different store or a different face to every customer that arrives on the web. Newspapers, for example, for a long time just presented the exact same front page on the web, the same front page they print out to every person that came to their website. And only now are they starting to say, oh, you know, we could actually show different news to different people depending on who they are and what they might be interested in reading.
And also that would lead to, obviously, things like recommendations based on previous purchases or previous searches. And that's sort of what you start to work on. Like, did you even have ideas in this direction that you even brought up in your initial interview with Amazon?
Well, that's right. I mean, I was in artificial intelligence at University of Washington, and at the time, there was a really popular movie recommender. This was really early in the kind of mid-90s. It recommended movies kind of like Netflix does now, and it was called Firefly. And I was fascinated.
Oh my God,
with it.
I can't believe I. You know what? I haven't thought about that in years. I remember using Firefly. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, Firefly back in the mid-90s. It was a very popular site. It would recommend, movies for you to watch based on the movies you had rated, just like Netflix does very well right now. I was fascinated by that. I thought that was great. And when I talked to Jeff, that was a big part of what I talked to him about. I said, you know, you should be doing this for books. You should be recommending the next book that people want to buy. You should help them find books. It's really, really hard to know about new books that come out. It's really hard to know about a book that you might be interested in that you would never think of searching for on your own because you don't even know it exists. But if you can help people discover that book, if you can surface that book for them, then you're doing them this huge this huge favor. You're giving them knowledge. I thought this was great.
In a way, that's you'd be able to do what the traditional bookstore, bookseller was able to do for people in person. Be the guy that says, well, here's the next book you should try, that sort of thing.
That's right. So, you know, when you go into, you know, this often happens in good bookstores, or, you know, I guess it's hard to rent movies anymore. There's not very many of those left. But, you know, it used to be the case that you go into a good geeky movie rental place, and you could tell them some movies you like, and they would recommend some other movies that you haven't seen yet. Same thing with books. And this is exactly that. You go to Amazon, and Amazon helps you find the next book you want to buy, just like that helpful clerk. And in fact, it's actually using people to do it as well. So the way that the computer is doing it isn't just magically coming up with these recommendations of the next book you might be interested in. Instead, what it's doing is looking at what other customers have found that you haven't found yet. So they're like, hey, you know, this customer looks just like you. They seem to be interested in just the same kind of books you are. And this customer found this book you haven't seen yet. So maybe you're going to be interested in that book, and it tells you what that other customer found. And it does that all without anyone having to do any work and all anonymously, which is just fantastic. And that's basically how the recommender algorithms work.
And obviously that's something we're all familiar with, that, you know, customers who bought this also bought whatever. Right. So when you guys are developing this idea, are there other... other sites, aside from the one that you mentioned, but like other companies that had tried stuff like this before, or are you basically feeling your way in the dark and inventing this yourselves?
Well, that's right. So the customers who bought this also bought Featured. Now, that's a really popular one, and that's kind of the easiest form of personalization. Basically, it just says, you know, you're looking at a book right now. Did you know that people who look at this book or people who buy this book also tend to be interested in these other books? And it's basically a correlation. It says, it's pretty much literally customers who bought this or customers who viewed this also were interested in, and it shows you that list. That was first done actually by another person at Amazon, a brilliant developer who'd been there from nearly the beginning, named Eric Benson. He came up with that customers who bought this also bought. I worked on it as well, but only later to optimize it. But he did all the early work on that. And that's a fantastic feature. It's incredibly helpful. I use it all the time to find new things. And I think and other people clearly do too.
Sure,
it shows
absolutely.
Up in all the metrics. Then on top of that, I built a recommendation engine. And the recommendation engine is very similar. It uses an algorithm called item-to-item collaborative filtering. And the way that works is it basically takes a list of things that you have bought in the past. It takes all your past purchases, and it says, what are all the things that are related to all the things you bought in the past? And it ranks them and then shows them to you as recommendations. So it's actually a pretty straightforward algorithm. It's very fast. If given enough data, it works really well. It can explain why it made a recommendation. So it can say, you're seeing this recommendation because you bought this and this in the past. That's a really nice feature. And the algorithms that existed at the time, including the algorithm that was used for Firefly, actually, the movie recommender we talked about earlier, didn't have a lot of these properties. It worked slightly differently. A little bit earlier, I described finding other customers who bought the same books as you. So I had said, let's go out and look for all the customers who seem to be similar to you, seem to behave like you, seem to be interested in the same things you are. Okay, now we found all these people, and they seem similar to you. Now, what did those people do that you haven't seen yet? And that's the original collaborative filtering algorithm. It's people-based instead of item-based. And unfortunately, the people-based version turns out to have a bunch of properties that means it doesn't work very well at really large scale. Like if you have millions of customers and millions of products, that algorithm just completely falls over. And that was the algorithm that was used by Firefly and a bunch of other people at the time. And this new algorithm turned out to be much faster, work much better, and it's the basis for a lot of the recommendations that are done on the Amazon site, including the ones that change the homepage.
And one of the problems that I read about, and by the way, a lot of the details I got for this, Greg has a blog that he's recounted a lot of his early Amazon stories, which I'll link to in the show notes, but one of the problems that I read about that I found fascinating was, like, for example, what if you have one product that's so popular almost everyone's going to buy it, like a Harry Potter book? When a new Harry Potter book comes out, like that could also create hiccups in the algorithms as well, right?
Right, that's exactly right. And so both of these two algorithms, actually, so the original collaborative filtering algorithm used by Firefly and others at the time, and this new algorithm, item-to-item collaborative filtering, are susceptible to what we call the Harry Potter problem, because we were a bookstore at the time. If you look at any customer, pretty much every customer had bought the book Harry Potter. And so if I am trying to generate recommendations and I look over my list of books, and it doesn't matter what you bought. If you buy, all science fiction, it's going to say, well, customers who bought those science fiction books also bought Harry Potter, And so, right. Because it's true, right? I mean, it's the most popular book to all customers, and it doesn't matter what you've done, it's going to recommend Harry Potter. So there turns out to be a tweak that you can do to get around that. And this turns out to be a really important tweak, both to the recommendation algorithms and to things like customers who bought this, which we called similarities at the time. And the tweak is, what you really want is the uniquely best-selling items, the items that are unusual to sell to this group of people. So Harry Potter isn't unusual to sell to someone. If you've bought a bunch of science fiction books, it's not people who buy a bunch of science fiction books don't buy Harry Potter at an unusually high rate. They just buy it at the same rate as everybody else. So you don't end up recommending Harry Potter anymore because Harry Potter doesn't stand out as an unusual book to buy if you've bought a bunch of science fiction. Likewise, if you bought a bunch of programming books, you'd now be recommended a programming book because people who buy a few programming books buy another programming book at a really high rate, unusually high rate compared to the people who, have bought romance novels.
So it's almost a combination of the algorithm is combining, the percentages, what you're likely to do, but also, the strong outliers. This is the most interesting, unusual thing that this group has in common.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, it looks for essentially unusual behavior if you've bought this book, what do people do at kind of an unusually high rate after buying that book? Well, they buy this other book, but Harry Potter isn't an unusual thing to do. You got to be a little bit careful with this, by the way. It's extremely easy to let things that kind of happen vanishingly small rates then get recommended. So you can end up, recommending really, really obscure titles if you go too far with this technique. And what you want is kind of something in the middle where you're not recommending things that are not unusual, but you're not recommending things that are extremely unusual and just, so out there that, only three people have bought it.
So you're doing this tinkering, you're coming up with these tweaks to recommendation technology, and you're kind of doing this on the side, this was your own initiative, and it wasn't initially assigned to you, right?
That's right. I mean, I was supposed to be working on other things like, keeping the website up, which I was doing. I was working a lot on performance. I launched a feature that allowed the website to display availability of the items in real time, which was something it couldn't do before. I did a bunch of other performance optimizations of the website. Later, I helped split the website, so I said it only ran on one web server. Later, I helped split it into pieces with a couple other people, some very talented other programmers who knew a lot more about that than I did. It was fantastic to work with some of these guys. That was one of the great things, is just how much you learn. On the side, almost like the famous Google 20% time, I kept working on things I really wanted to work on. One example of that was the recommendation engine. So that was not a sanctioned project. I built that entirely on my own and coded up a prototype, and then it just ended up launching because the prototype was so convincing.
Well, actually, and once it does launch, is the data positive in terms of, wow, this really had an effect on sales, jumping percentages and things like that?
That's right. And, in order to figure all that out, actually, the Amazon site at the time didn't have the ability to figure out, what was leading to sales. Like, let's say a sale comes in, someone gets all the way through the order process, they buy the book. Well, how do you do credit assignment? How do you say, okay, let's go back through the website and figure out what was responsible for that sale? Who gets credit, right? Was it search that generated that sale? Did the person go through the browse categories, go down through books and then science fiction?
What we would think of as basic analytics, user flow and stuff like that today.
Right. This stuff is all routine nowadays. But this is way back in '97, beginning of the web. People haven't dealt with logs of this size. People haven't dealt with websites of this size. It's extremely common, if you have a web server, to have one machine, right? And the database running on the same machine. It's unusual to have them split out at this point, right? So this is really, really early. And so I, ended up building a lot of that analytics framework so that we could say what was resulting in the sales. Oh, look, it's the recommendation system that's resulting in the sales. We should get credit for that. Later, a different team built out the experimental platform, which was fantastic. So this was extremely early again. This is back in the late 90s. Right around 97, actually. And Amazon, if it wasn't the first, it was definitely one of the first to have the ability to run A-B tests. So this is an experimental platform, an A-B test, where you show different customers a different website. So customer A sees this website, customer B sees this website. And the websites are usually very subtly different. Like, this website might be showing the most popular books on the homepage. This other website might be showing a list of recommended books based on your purchase history. And when you have that ability to say, okay, well, this group of customers A saw the popular books content, this group of customers B saw the recommendation content, and then you have that credit assignment ability, so you can say, well, who generated the sale? And you can trace it all the way back to that popular book content or that recommendation content. Now you have the ability to say, who wins, right? Was it, which is better? Should we put the popular book content up there or the recommendation list content up there? And when you have that ability, it's incredibly powerful, because you don't have to decide things by some executive saying, like, I want my marketing ad up at the top of the homepage. Instead, you can say, well, if you put that marketing ad up on the top of the homepage, it's going to lower sales by 3%. Do you have the budget to compensate for that 3%? Right? You don't have to have an executive saying, like, okay, well, we want to feature editorial reviews up at the top of the site. You can say, okay, well, let's run an A-B test. Okay, well, when we put the editorial reviews at the top of the site, we lost 2% of sales, so you can't put the editorial reviews on the top of the website. So no longer are you relying on what's sometimes referred to as the highest paid person's opinion, HIPPO. Instead, you can actually test things and determine what works best and what doesn't. And the recommendation content tended to work really, really well. It generated a lot of sales.
And we'll say again, I mean, this is incredibly common today, down to the level of, you know, testing different shades of blue for to get that, you know, 0.3% change in activations or clicks or anything like that. But you're arguing that Amazon was the first to do this, obviously in commerce, but maybe to do this for websites on a large scale anywhere.
Right. I mean, I think Amazon, at least to my knowledge, Amazon was the first to do this. If they weren't the first, they were one of the first. You know, Google is well known for running just enormous numbers of tests on their website now. That shades of color example that you gave, Google, you know, runs tests in order to see if the tiny differences in the shade of color make a difference in their metrics on search quality. But, you know, you have to remember, this is way back in 1997. This is the very early days. This is, you know, before cookies were, you know, web-based cookies were common. This is way before JavaScript, way before CSS, way before any of this stuff, way before, you know, there was scale-out, way before people had thousands of machines to run their website. You know, most websites ran on one machine. At this point. So this is really early days, and Amazon is really early in building this kind of experimental platform.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You mentioned scale, and it seems like you know, every company that I delve into, every person that I talk to, someone has a crazy story of, you know, the time the site went down, or the time we thought we lost that server and we lost all the customer records. Was it a difficult thing to start to scale up to millions of customers, and then, you know, not just one machine, but, you know, a room full of machines, and then a warehouse full of machines and things like that? Like, what were the growing pains like in terms of achieving the unbelievable scale that Amazon would eventually achieve?
Well, that's right. I mean, we could barely keep the wheels on the bus at this point. It was a constant struggle, especially around Christmas time. You know, most retailers, their sales, pretty much all of their sales and profit comes in around the holiday season. And around Christmas time, you know, we'd have to scale up to handle, you know, four times the load. And then, kind of oddly, that load would usually stick. So, you know, it wasn't like you'd scale up for four times the load and then the load would drop back down. Instead, you know, every Christmas it would jump up just some ridiculous amount and then stay there. And then next, you know, keep going up for the next year, and then around Christmas jump by some ridiculous amount again. And so, we had to, you know, when I first came, there was one web server, a huge amount of dependencies in the code on the idea of having one web server. It accessed information off of, you know, remote file systems. There's a technique, it's been so long. I think it's NFS. So it was NFS. And it basically would mount the drive off of another system and then access it, and that was incredibly fragile and a single point of failure. There was only one other database. The database wasn't, you know, nowadays it's just routine to have multiple databases, but this is way before databases supported replication. This is way at this point, Cisco produced load balancers, but this was the extremely early days of load balancers. So the load balancers were really flaky. You know, they didn't work properly to try to distribute your load across multiple web servers. And we had to do everything with kind of taking, what was a very rapidly written code base with lots of dependencies on it being a single web server, and turn it into multiple web servers and eliminate any dependencies on the file system. And nowadays, again, this is all commonplace. But this is the early days of the web, and I think Amazon, was one of the first to do this. I know at the time eBay, for example, was trying to make a decision about whether to do scale out to lots of cheap Linux servers or whether to scale up and just add much, much more hardware and essentially start running on a supercomputer instead of running on multiple computers. And they chose scale up at this point. So for years, they were just continuing to run on more and more powerful computers to avoid this problem of splitting onto multiple sites. And, today that sounds kind of silly, right? Because everyone's so used to scale out. But at the time, there was a real debate about this. Do you scale out or scale up? And a lot of people were on the scale up side. It was actually pretty unusual to lean towards scale out. Google is well known for doing scale out too, of course, with their corkboard servers, their famous corkboard servers where they Sergey and Larry, basically just attached computer components to a corkboard with push pins and kind of shoved them into a cabinet in order to get their early servers. So Google was very early too in using lots of cheap servers.
You mentioned eBay, and I'm beginning work on researching eBay. So I've spoken to my first couple of eBay people. I've gotten the story of when Amazon goes into auctions from their side of it, but that's another project that you mentioned on your blog. So I'd love to hear the Amazon side of the foray into auctions.
that was a crazy project. Jeff, at one point saw how well eBay was doing. I think he got concerned, and he wanted to launch something very similar using the auction model. At the time, the thought was the auction model was the key to eBay's success. So this bidding process was really what was driving eBay's growth, and it was very addictive, very fun. And so the whole pricing model of bidding at the time was thought to be what was really important. Now, eBay at this point, that sounds kind of silly now because eBay at this point has actually switched mostly to a fixed price model. There still is bidding on the site, but they're actually much closer to Amazon or Overstock now, because they do a lot of liquidations, and used stuff. So almost closer to Amazon now. But at the time, the important thing was thought to be this kind of fun pricing model of bidding. So anyway, the secret project kicked off inside of Amazon. I think this may have been right after Christmas, I think. So we were all exhausted from trying to keep the wheels on the bus as the crushing Christmas retail load came in.
And we should point out again that obviously it's all hands on deck at that point. Like you yourself are going into the warehouse to pack packages and stuff at that point.
That's right. When it gets to the point, as it starts to get closer to Christmas, you can't launch a feature anymore. You can't launch code to the website anymore. You've done the scaling work you're going to be able to do. The only things you can launch at that point are things that are just like catastrophic bug fixes, like, sales are dropping or, there's an infinite loop or something and you launch something just to fix that. But as it gets really close to Christmas, like, you do not want to launch anything that changes the code anymore because you risk the stability of the website and the amount of sales you might lose if there's a, you know, a 30-minute website outage is just so large that you wouldn't even consider launching any changes anymore. So it's kind of funny because the software engineers are super critical, you know, coming in the months up to Christmas, and all of a sudden, you know, your programming ability is useless, right? Because you can't launch code anyway. And the only important thing is getting books, you know, wrapped in, you know, packages and out the door, right? So all the programmers ended up going down, you know, to the warehouse, or, you know, customer service also gets a really crushing load. So a lot of people are sitting at their desk answering emails. So you might actually have been talking to one of Amazon's programmers when you would email Amazon and say, hey, where's my book? You know, it might have been someone who actually, you know, wrote core pieces of a website, you know, answering your, your customer service email. So that's right. I mean, that's what the Christmas season was like. And then with the auctions, you know, we were just kind of recovering from that crushing Christmas load. And, you know, a secret project kicks off. We're given three months to build eBay. That's what we're told to do. We're told, you know, you have 3 months. You have to replicate essentially everything eBay has. And so, you know, first we try to figure out, okay, what does that actually mean? And, you know, okay, well, a couple of these things here and there can be dropped. But then, you know, basically in the 2.5 months we had left at that point, we had to build everything eBay had done over years. And we did. And we launched this auction site, and it turned out to be a complete flop in large part because you know, there were just not enough buyers and sellers. It didn't have the critical mass. And, you know, in retrospect, some of us argued this at the time, but in retrospect, you know, going whole hog after eBay, trying to go after every part of their business was pretty arrogant. What Amazon probably should have done is pick off areas like, you know, books and music, and said, okay, you know, we're going to be, you know, the place to do auctions for books or music. Or they could have done liquidations or something, something that's kind of a segment, and pick that piece off and then expand. And ultimately, that is actually what Amazon did. They launched the ability for third-party sellers to use Amazon's catalog, which is one of Amazon's big advantages over eBay, is the catalog that says, you know, these are our real books. And third-party sellers could say, okay, I want to sell that book too. But the auction part was dropped. It went to fixed price. And ultimately, a very successful product did get launched out of it. It's just the attempt to kind of take eBay on, you know, with this full frontal assault, very ambitious, in 3 months. Even though the code was pretty glorious, you know, it was pretty much eBay just reproduced. It didn't have the critical mass, and it just couldn't succeed from a business standpoint.
Right. You stay at Amazon through 2002, 2003, right?
Oh, that's right.
And yep. And you're staying, though, involved heavily in the personalization aspect of things, correct?
That's right. I was working in personalization and recommendations pretty much the entire time.
So, you know, it's so funny because that's so much of what we think of Amazon is that it is things like how personalized it is, and it seems like if that's something that Amazon as a company evolved into, maybe it's because it fit like that customer centric model. Like, how do you feel like this obsession with personalization and data like that sort of took over at Amazon?
Well, I do think you know, Jeff was a computer scientist actually, so I do think he really liked some aspects of automating the website and this idea of discovery that computers could help people find books that they couldn't find themselves. You can't search for something you don't know about. So you can find books that you know exist on Amazon, but you can't find a book that you don't know exists. And I think Jeff himself was very interested in this idea of discovery. How do you find the great book you don't know exists? So he was enormously supportive of that. Also, he was pretty willing to, there's been other executives that are much more hierarchical and authoritarian and, insist on kind of a strict top-down structure. He was very willing to have people, even me at, low levels of the company, just a programmer, talk to him and tell him that he was wrong, or talk to other executives and tell them they were wrong. We could do that, and he would back us up, especially if we were proven to be right, ultimately. Actually, a really nice story on this, if I can tell it.
Absolutely.
Is the shopping cart recommendations, which is an incredibly useful feature. And this uses the recommendation engine again. And it's it basically says, people who bought the things that are in your shopping cart also bought, and recommends other items you might want to add to your shopping cart. And the intent here is to be a little bit like the impulse buys at the checkout lane, right? So, when you go to the supermarket, you fill up your shopping cart with stuff, and you go to checkout, and there's, those candy bars and the, the mints and all the other little impulse buys sitting there trying to get themselves to be added to your cart, right? They're just sitting there, and you're like, oh, okay, I'll buy that candy bar, right? Well, the idea with the shopping cart recommendations is to be a much better version of that. So it would be like if you rolled your shopping cart up to the checkout lane and those impulse buys magically rearranged themselves based on what's in your shopping cart. So if you, were buying mostly candy, it might still be candy bars. But if you, were buying, if you were buying lots of fruit, it might be showing you, other types of fruit that you might want to add to your cart. So it'd be much more targeted and personalized impulse buys, trying to get you to add a few more things as you're on your way out the door. And what was interesting about this is it's a great example of the highest person's, highest paid person's opinion, the hippo, not winning at Amazon. So I prototyped this feature and showed it around. A lot of people were interested in it, but one of the executives said no. He said, I'm too worried that it's going to distract people from checking out. So his fear, and this is legitimate, his fear was that people would see these impulse buys and be like, wow, that's really cool, and I'm going to click on that
distracted.
And look at that. And they get distracted, and they'd never check out. They'd forget to check out. They'd abandon their cart. And that is a legitimate view. But he actually took a pretty hard line on it. He said, I know I'm right about this. I know the abandons are going to be huge, and this is going to cost us sales, so no, you can't launch this feature. And I just went ahead and ran an A-B test anyway. So I actually didn't tell him. I just ran the A-B test. And so a small percentage of customers saw the shopping cart. And what we saw, we ran this A-B test, this experiment, and what we saw is a huge bump in sales. It was an enormously successful feature, and the abandons didn't go up at all. We couldn't even detect a change in people abandoning their cart. So, despite this being a legitimate concern, the data said, launch this thing immediately. And that's what we did. We launched it immediately. And, it's a great example of data winning out over opinion. And anytime you can have data win out over opinion, it's definitely the way to go.
And so you're positing that's one of Bezos' strength, is that he's willing to follow the data, the logical data, no matter what.
That's right. I mean, he views, customer satisfaction as being the top thing. And if you can show on a measure of, customer happiness, and sales is definitely a measure of customer happiness. It's an imperfect one, but it's one of them. If you can show that customers are happier with this feature than they were without, you win. And it doesn't really matter what other people's opinions are about it. Your feature goes up. And that was Jeff's leadership. Jeff said, if you can prove in the data that this feature should be launched, we will launch the feature.
A couple of blue sky questions related to that sort of
sure.
thing. To work for Bezos personally, he's very demanding. I've heard from other people, but at the same time, you're describing that he's also very open-minded. So, like, just generally, like, what was your opinion of him as a leader and a boss?
Well, actually, I liked him a lot and got along with him a lot, but I think part of the reason for that, part of the reason for other people's more negative reaction is that he has an extremely negative reaction to people trying to, pull something over on him, trying to BS him. If you try to do that to him, he's a very smart guy, and if you try to do that to him and you don't admit, if you screw up and you don't admit you screwed up, he's going to come after you, right? Because you need to say, I screwed up, and then he'll be like, okay, you screwed up. What are we going to do about it now, right? That's fine, right? Or, if you are pitching a feature to him and he brings up an objection to your feature and you don't have a good response to that, and you try to just kind of, slime your way through it, he's going to have a really negative reaction, and he's just not going to let go. He will just keep pounding at that thing until you either say, like, I don't know, I will go, figure out how to deal with that. That's a legitimate thing. Or you present him with a real argument that he shouldn't be concerned about that, that is based on data and not just, you trying to kind of hide the thing and kind of smooth it over. So my impression of him actually is that he is a pleasant guy. I've actually never met Bill Gates, but I've heard Bill Gates also has this property where if you try to go in front of him and, don't admit error or try to pull something over on him, you get in a lot of trouble with him. And I think Jeff has that feature as well. And some people don't like that. I personally love it, but some people don't like that.
Two more blue sky questions that are related. On a personal level, the company you join is a small outfit. You can know the handful of people that are working there, and your desk is in the kitchen. On a personal level, what's it like to ride this amazing ride where within a few years, you have sales of billions of dollars, you have tens and hundreds of millions of customers? Like, what was that like, just that explosion of growth, and how do you handle that on a personal level?
Well, I'd say it was both, awesome and painful. It was awesome in that it was very exciting to be part of this growth and part of this company that's impacted so many, that's changed, retail in the United States. That is very exciting. But what's not so great about it? I mean, I did join a bookstore. I really wanted to sell books. I was really excited about helping people find knowledge. That was a huge part of my motivation. And as the company grew and moved into other product lines, I was still pretty excited. But then as the company grew again, people started coming into the company that didn't have that same drive to see the company succeed. And this is totally understandable. This is actually my problem, not theirs. They would come in much later and, they'd be focused on their little piece and wouldn't be concerned about something else or the bigger picture. Or much worse, some people started to come in around the time of the IPO that were just kind of latching on, trying to get rich quick, and didn't have kind of the interest in the company itself in selling books and selling knowledge that I had. I found that kind of discouraging. But that was really my problem with not being able to adjust to the growth. I mean, I could go back there now. You know, it's a large company now, but I've been in Microsoft too. That's a enormous company. I could go back there now and have no problem. It was just at the time to make that transition was very difficult personally for me, and I think a lot of the other early people also had some difficulty with that transition.
So the related question then is, this is a little beyond where we've gotten in the podcast in terms of chronology, but you stay there through the dot-com bubble bursting. And I'm wondering, was there, being an employee at Amazon in late 2001, 2002, 2003, was there a fear possibly that Amazon might go under at any point?
No, not really. Not that. Not a fear that it would go under. I mean, there were some issues. I mean, a high-level executive, Joe Galli, came in, and he wasn't very popular. So there were, you know, there were some morale issues that came up, I would say. I don't think anyone thought the company was, you know, was financially unstable or all a scam or something at any point. You know, there was I think some kind of famous article in .com or something.
Right.
But that was not a view inside the company. You know, the morale problems, I think, were more created by things like Joe Galli than, you know, the crash. And the crash had very little to do with why I left. I left because the company had grown bigger and I was, you know, having trouble adjusting to its new size. And also I was getting a little bored. I wanted to move on to something else, something new. In particular, I wanted to try a startup. I was also really fascinated with the idea of applying personalization and recommendations to information. So I was focused on this idea of information overload, that there's so much news and email and everything coming in to our lives, and what if we could use personalization and recommendations to help filter that and help discover things you didn't know about yet, that news article that you wouldn't think of searching for and wouldn't find on your own. So I was really fascinated with those kind of ideas and wanted to work on those. There was no way to work on those within Amazon.
But that does become Findery, which you found in 2003. And Findery eventually sells to Microsoft. That's how you end up at Microsoft, right?
That's right, right. And then I went to Microsoft for a little while. And since then, I've been working in educational games. I've always wanted to work in games and education, and I finally have a chance to do that. So that's been a lot of fun.
We'll end with that in just a second, but because it is interesting to me that the through line in your career is this this obsession maybe is a strong word, but this idea of personalization that you keep plugging away at, and you do it in Findery, personalization of news and discovery of news that would be of interest. I'm curious how what you think of the personalization, not industry, but technology today in the age of social. I mean, because obviously, you know, we've mentioned Netflix a bunch of times, and it, things like having personalized cues and personalized news, it seems so common and everyday now, but I'm wondering what you think of how that technology has evolved.
Well, I do think it's become much, much more commonplace. You know, the item-to-item collaborative filtering algorithm was brand new. No one had done that back in 97. Amazon put it in place, and nowadays it's used all over the place. I mean, YouTube uses it, Google uses it, and Netflix has used it at various points. I'm not exactly sure what they're using right now. You know, Netflix has just done a tremendous job with their personalization and recommendations. Their entire site is just one giant recommendation engine. Mm-hmm. Apparently, something like 85% of movie views go through something that's been processed by their recommendation engine. Only 15% are coming from search, which is just crazy. I mean, usually search is by far dominant. So Netflix is just a tremendous example of personalization. But there's still so many opportunities for it. You know, newspapers are doing a pretty miserable job of surfacing the news you're interested in. I think. The whole idea of personalization of information that I was very interested in, I think, has only barely been done. Search engines like Google still don't pay much attention to any of your past behavior. They're just starting to pay a little more attention to it now, but it's always, when you do a Google search, it's always been treated as a one-shot deal. You know, you do this search, and then you do another search, and you know, that other search is completely independent of that first search you did, and that's never true. It's almost always the case that when you do searches on Google, you're doing one search, and then you're like, oh, I didn't find what I wanted, so you do another search, mm-hmm. you refine your search, and then you do another search, and you refine that. And if you know, Google's just showing you the same results they showed everyone else and ignoring that information of what you just didn't find and what you just did. So personalized search is still in its infancy. Personalized advertising is still very early on. The height of the technology right now is often just refinding. So that's, you know, look, you browsed and saw, you know, this movie on Overstock. So now when you go to the BBC homepage, we're going to show you that same movie again on the BBC homepage and be like, hey, you know, you looked at that movie. Maybe you want to go buy that movie again, you know, and that kind of refinding is a very simple form of personalization. And it could be much, much better. Like, imagine if the advertising instead was like, oh, you know, you looked at that movie. Well, did you know that this other movie, which people who like that movie, is on sale, and you can get it, you know, in Blu-ray for, you know, $7. And you'd be like, whoa, I didn't know that. That's, you know, I just discovered something through, you know, your advertising on the BBC site. I'm going to go buy that right now, right? They don't do that yet. There's none of that kind of personalization and recommendation yet of information going on, or the level that is going on is still extremely early.
You know what, while you're saying that, you gave me an idea of a company you didn't mention, which is Twitter, and I'm going to suggest that you go talk to Twitter and help them. If I could get the tweets that I would really want to see, bubble up for me, that would totally revolutionize Twitter, especially for like casual or early Twitter users or something. So that's my two cents. Go help Twitter out.
That's a great idea, and it's an idea that's kind of been kicked around in a few ways. You know, there's a few apps that try to process your Twitter feed. Often they filter by social relationships. So, you know, this other person that you follow, seemed interested in this tweet, and so we're going to surface that to the top rather than showing you it in strict chronological order, that kind of thing. And Twitter itself has a discovery feature that's trying to do a little bit of the personalization. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit hidden. It's not their main timeline. Mm-hmm. Again, they don't really work that well. There's a lot of work to be done on all those to get them to really work well.
Well, before we go, do tell me a little bit about what you're up to now about Geeky Ventures and Crunchzilla.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, you know, going back to my theme of... I mean, there's a famous line that, I've ruined many careers by getting bored, and I think that's kind of a theme in my career where, you know, I was at Amazon, and I could have continued going at Amazon, but, to some extent I was bored, to some extent a little frustrated and wanted to do something else, and then I did this startup, and then, you know, got a little bored with that, and then I had this dream of always wanting to work at Microsoft Research. I didn't quite get to work at Microsoft Research, but I got to work near them, which was fantastic. I mean, the people at Microsoft mm-hmm. Research are just brilliant. So that was unbelievably great. And then I got a little bored with that, and Microsoft actually did its first layoffs ever, so that was pretty discouraging. And so I left among that. And then worked on something else that I always wanted to work on that's just radically different, which is games and education. In particular, I launched a series of websites that teach kids to code. This was pretty early. This was before code.org was so so prevalent with the hour of code idea.
Mm-hmm, right.
They're doing a magnificent job, by the way. I mean, they have gotten just tremendous numbers of people to try at least a little bit of coding. Scratch at MIT has also gotten a tremendous number of people to try just a little bit of coding, and those are both just absolutely fantastic. And I can't recommend Khan Academy's new CS program enough, too. That's fantastic, too. It's a little bit similar to Crunchzilla's stuff. The big difference, Crunchzilla's stuff is a little bit more advanced in that you write in real code. All the code can be just cut and pasted out and run in a web page. None of the other sites have that property, so it's all learning real usable coding skills, and it's mostly intended for kids, although, you know, curious adults can try it too. Mm-hmm. If it Crunchzilla.
Excellent. Greg Linden, thank you so much for taking the time to remember all that for us.
Oh sure, it was really fun.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.